Apple makes a bid for Beats. The Federal Trade Commission on data brokers. 1 year ago this week began a series of surveillance-related revelations. That's not all, but it's a start. Welcome back to 40 A&M in 5, the weekly download of 40 A&M LLC. It's Monday, June 2nd, and I'm Chris Bohm. First up, on Wednesday of last week, Apple confirmed that it intended to buy Beats, the enormously popular headphone business and subscription streaming music service. The deal, which would be Apple's biggest acquisition ever, would be for $3 billion, $2.6 billion initially, and an additional $400 million over time. According to CNET's Shara Tibkin, before the Beats acquisition was announced, Apple's largest public acquisition was in 1996, with the $429 million it spent to acquire Steve Jobs' own software maker, Next. In announcing the deal, Apple was effusive about its appreciation for Beats' co-founders, whom the company called sound pioneers, adding, according to the Wall Street Journal, that Apple CEO Tim Cook said that, "We think that Beats is the first one to really get subscription services right." For its part, iTunes and Apple's senior VP Eddie Q, in charge of that division, believes that the Beats lineup will enhance iTunes purchasing and iTunes radio with subscriptions, particularly through Beats' status as the brand of choice in the music and sports worlds. Apple expects to close the deal sometime close to the end of its fourth quarter in September. The Federal Trade Commission issued a report on Tuesday of this past week on an analysis that the FTC has made of the data broker industry, emphasizing that consumers do benefit from data broker practices which, for example, help consumers to find and enjoy the products and services they prefer. But the commission also declared that the data broker industry operates, in its words, with a fundamental lack of transparency. The commission goes on to recommend that Congress consider legislation to make what data broker practices not only more transparent, but also give consumers greater control over what information is collected and how it is used. In announcing the report's release, Federal Trade Commission Chairwoman Edith Ramirez highlighted that the data brokers today know as much or even more about us than our family and friends, including our online and in-store purchases, our political and religious affiliations, our income and socioeconomic status, and more. In completing the study, the FTC had analyzed 9 data brokers representing a cross-section of industry. The report found that just one of the 9 data brokers profiled holds information on more than 1.4 billion consumer transactions and 700 million data elements, adding more than 3 billion new data points to its database each month. Much of this data, according to the report, is culled from extensive online and offline sources without the consumer's knowledge, including social media activity, warranty registrations, magazine subscriptions, supermarket loyalty card programs, and the data is combined and analyzed in order for the firms to make inferences about the consumer, often potential sensitive inferences, such as about their ethnicity, income, religion, political leanings, age, and health condition. One such category, Rural Everlasting, noted by the FTC, catalogs single men and women over the age of 66 with what the brokers characterize as low educational attainment and low net worth. Other potentially sensitive categories focus on conditions such as pregnancy, diabetes, and high cholesterol. In still other categories, the FTC noted, could possibly be used for beneficial practices such as biker enthusiasts, a category which could be used to provide discounts on motorcycle paraphernalia to a consumer. But the same category could also be used by an insurance company as an indicia of potentially risky or higher risk behavior. In January, President Obama had tasked senior advisor John Podesta to complete a White House review of big data, its potential uses, policy-related concerns, and possibilities for abuse. That review culminated last month also with the issuance of a lengthy report. Where the FTC's report last week focuses on issues of transparency and the need for greater consumer protection notices and tools, the White House team looked more broadly at diverse government policies that may be impacted or need to be adjusted in the face of growing big data analytics. The FTC recommended such developments as a centralized internet portal where data brokers can identify themselves, describe their information collection and use practices, and provide links to user access tools and opt-outs. For consumer-facing entities, such as retailers who rely on data brokers or engage in their own analytics, the FTC would have the retailer provide a prominent notice to consumers when they share data with brokers and provide a means to opt out of the sharing. In addition, to further protect sensitive information, such as health-related data, the FTC would require retailers and other consumer-facing entities to obtain affirmative express consent from a consumer before information is collected and shared. In one area, both the FTC and the White House team were in particular alignment. The issue of when data broker analytics, and particular inferences about a consumer, can impact inclusion or exclusion from a service or potential transaction. The Podesta report highlighted that the federal government's lead civil rights and consumer protection agencies would be expected to expand technical expertise and staffing in order to identify practices and outcomes that have discriminatory impact, whether intentionally or inadvertently. For its part, the FTC emphasized that where a data broker's risk mitigation strategy, which relies upon an inference made about the consumer, might limit a consumer's ability to complete a transaction, the retailer or other consumer-facing company would be required to inform the consumer of which data broker's information the company relied upon. Unless you've been on a deserted island in the South Pacific, it would have been hard over the past few weeks to miss the fact that next week marks a year since the revelations of NSA surveillance activities were first leaked by Edward Snowden. 2 weeks ago, PBS's Frontline news show debuted a two-part episode detailing not only the waves of further revelations since June 5, 2013, but included interviews with dozens of past government officials, technical experts, and reporters to build a post-9/11 timeline of U.S. surveillance activity development, its drivers in the war on terror, and how policy-related aftermath continues to shape our lives. On Wednesday of last week, NBC News anchor Brian Williams debuted an hour-long interview that he had conducted with Edward Snowden himself, filmed at a secret location in Russia, where Snowden presently is living in exile. The interview itself offered little in terms of any new revelations. Snowden took pains to emphasize that he neither has any of the linked material nor has access to it anymore. What the interview did offer, though, was the world's first real glimpse of Mr. Snowden, his manner, and his thoughts on those first revelations through the present aftermath. Regardless of how you may feel about Mr. Snowden and what he has done, if you tuned into the interview, you found a subject that was very well-spoken, quietly confident, and introspective. He continued to emphasize his respect for intelligence and for his colleagues in the intelligence community. And in the wake of the interview, and Mr. Snowden's reaffirmation that he'd attempted to raise his concerns through channels in the agency, there has been considerable back and forth in the media over whether or not, to the NSA's belief, Mr. Snowden did indeed run those channels to air his concerns. In answer to a question from Brian Williams, Snowden emphasized that he does not, nor has he ever, worked for Russia or met President Putin. And in fact, he was highly critical of Russia's recent passage of a blogger registration law. When asked why he didn't simply come home to the U.S. and face the music, as had been the suggestion earlier in the week from Secretary of State John Kerry, Snowden echoed what his attorney had already told the Guardian newspaper, that the Espionage Act, under which he has been charged in the U.S., does not permit a defendant to argue to the jury that what a person did might have been in the public interest. In the face of a possible maximum sentence of 30 years under the current charges, Snowden and his legal team believe that because of the Espionage Act, he would be returning to face a stacked deck. One moment of humor in the interview concerned Edward Snowden's comments about Brian Williams' mobile phone. When asked to comment about it, Snowden replied that the NSA, the Russian intelligence service, the Chinese intelligence service, any intelligence service in the world with significant funding and a real technological research team, can own that phone, in his words, the minute it connects to their network. They can even turn on the phone remotely if it's off, he added. Brian Williams replied that the iPhone 5 he had with him was a single-use burner, to which Edward Snowden replied, "If that's the case, then it's the most expensive burner I've ever seen." The NBC News interview is available to stream on NBC's site, as well as expert commentary that NBC had organized for after-interview analysis. In addition, this week, the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C. will be holding a series of panel discussions entitled the NSA debate 1 year later. On June 4th, the subject will be the international implications, while the following day, on June 5th, a panel will discuss the future of U.S. surveillance authorities. The U.S. Freedom Act, the surveillance reform proposal that has developed the most traction in the Congress since the revelations began last June, passed a committee vote last week and could come to the floor of the House for a vote as early as this week. Numerous outlets were reporting this past week on the iPhone and iPad so-called ransom attack, which apparently was not caused by an iCloud hack at all, as was assumed early on in the blogosphere. A number of iPhone and iPad owners in the UK and Australia had found on Tuesday that their devices displayed a message that they had been hacked, their devices locked, and that the users should use PayPal to pay roughly $100 equivalent to a Hotmail address to have it unlocked. According to Apple, the hack was the result of a phishing scheme where the hacker gained access to the owner's iCloud account, which are linked to every iPhone and iPad, and turned on the Find My Phone setting. This can be configured to remotely lock the device with a passcode if the owner hadn't already accessed the feature and set it. To avoid the phishing scheme and similar, Apple recommended that impacted users reset their Apple ID password as soon as possible and avoid using the same name and password for multiple services, thereby decreasing the possibility of a successful phishing attack. On May 22nd, Microsoft General Counsel and Executive Vice President Brad Smith posted a blog to Microsoft's TechNet site, detailing the company's successful challenge to a national security letter issued to it by the FBI. National security letters allow FBI officials to send requests to web and telecommunications companies requesting account information, with the presumption that the information is relevant to a national security investigation. Last December, Microsoft had announced a commitment to notify business and government customers if the company received legal orders related to their data. And with this commitment, Microsoft added that if a gag order attempted to prohibit the company from fulfilling this goal, they would challenge it. In this particular Microsoft case, as with many other national security letters, the letter included such a non-disclosure provision or gag order. And Microsoft, feeling that the provision was unlawful and violated a constitutional right to free expression, challenged the letter in federal court in Seattle. In the face of the challenge, the FBI decided to withdraw the letter, according to Microsoft. As Mr. Smith pointed out, national security letter requests for customer data belonging to an enterprise customer are extremely rare. Most often, Microsoft, as Mr. Smith related, attempts to redirect the government to the enterprise customer itself to provide the data, or gets permission from the customer to provide it on its behalf. The latter situation, given the gag order, was presumably impossible here. As Mr. Smith added in his blog, this is not the first time that Microsoft has challenged a national security letter, but the fact of the blog seems to imply that this was the first such challenge since Microsoft made its policy commitment in December. The challenge and its success does highlight, though, a perhaps increasing willingness to challenge the legitimacy and/or secret context of the letters. Driving this shift by industry is in part a desire to provide distance in the wake of continuing surveillance disclosures. However, the willingness may also stem from a March 2013 U.S. District Court opinion in San Francisco that invalidated, as unconstitutional, the gag order placed on a national security letter, a letter which was also subsequently withdrawn. Until 2013, few national security letters had ever been challenged. But by the close of 2013, according to Frontline, Google alone had challenged 19. One can understand why authorities would seek non-disclosure of an investigative request made in a national security letter, particularly if non-disclosure keeps evidence from being destroyed or a terrorist from going into hiding. But the gag order placed on national security letters is certainly unique. In the context of surveillance that has not been identified by the government as related to national security interests, law enforcement has traditionally notified people directly impacted by searches and seizures, though not immediately, often delayed by weeks or months, after investigators entered a home or tapped a phone line. This is particularly true if the search, seizure, or tap proved of little or no use to investigators. The individual was made aware, ironically, just 2 months prior to the first NSA surveillance revelations on June 5, 2013, The FBI had proposed to the White House adjustments to search and seizure rules, but reportedly, no change to post-tap procedure was suggested for the online world. Litigating the legitimacy or constitutionality of national security letters is a costly prospect, as the defense against such a suit is also for government. One of the points made by Frontline. But while such challenges may be generating irretrievable sum costs for both parties, a lose-lose for both the government and industry, any restraint and accountability that the challenges might foster in the national security letter process may be worth the risk for an industry working hard to maintain user trust. Back in October, U.S. House Bill H.R. 3035 was being debated, which would provide for reporting by companies of both national security letter requests and FISA, or Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court requests. In addition to Microsoft, America Online, Apple, Facebook, Foursquare, Google, LinkedIn, Mozilla, Tumblr, Twitter, and Yahoo were among the companies who wrote an October 30th open letter supporting both the measure and Senate Judiciary Chairman Leahy's longstanding support for national security letter reform. On Wednesday morning at approximately 9 a.m. Eastern Standard Time in the U.S., Maya Angelou died in her home in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. Her death had been confirmed by her longtime literary agent, Ms. Helen Bran, and although no immediate cause of death had been released, it was known that she had been in frail health for some time. Ms. Angelou first sprang into the American consciousness with her heartfelt and evocative memoir in 1969 entitled I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings. The book would go on to have five sequels, penned by Maya Angelou, in which she recounted her many careers and life experiences, including as a dancer, calypso singer, streetcar conductor, reportedly the first woman conductor in San Francisco, single mother, magazine editor in Cairo, and administrative assistant in Ghana. Of all the tributes and obituaries that I read this past week, and there were many, the best characterization of her writing that I found came from her own hometown paper, the Winston-Salem Journal, which wrote that in her writing, she explored the concepts of personal identity and resilience through the multifaceted lens of race, sex, family, community, and the collective past. And her work gave an often clear-eyed and sobering view of the ways in which social marginalization can play out at the level of the individual. The Winston-Salem Journal called her an introspective person who would sometimes hole up in a hotel room with a deck of cards to play solitaire, as she wrote. But that, as a site-specific extrovert, she was also a born entertainer who loved a crowd and to sing, dance, or act. Human beings are more alike than we are unlike, the journal was said she was fond of saying. For inasmuch as Maya Angelou would ascend the heights of celebrity and achievement after her first memoir in 1969, from Tony-nominated stage actress, college professor, and lecturer, to frequent guest on shows from Oprah to Sesame Street, her manner, voice, and directness would always maintain a quality rooted in experience and reflection. In short, she knew who she was and how her life related to those around her on a human level better than most. As said in the New York Times, her voice recalled African-American oral tradition and gave her work the quality of testimony. She was also intimately concerned with sensation, describing the world around her, be it her birthplace in Arkansas, San Francisco, or the foreign cities in which she lived, with a palpable feeling of its sights, sounds, and smells. She had been born in 1928, had just turned 86 on April 4th, and for a long time had neglected to celebrate her own birthday, because it coincidentally was also the day on which Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated in 1968. Maya Angelou had canceled an event in Fayetteville, Arkansas in April, because she was recovering from an unexpected ailment, and she gave her last phone interview to a radio host in Canada just several weeks ago. In 1981, Wake Forest University offered Maya Angelou the Reynolds Professorship in American Studies, a lifetime appointment, and she made Winston-Salem her home. But today's generation may know her best from her poem, On the Pulse of the Morning, which she read at President Bill Clinton's inauguration in 1993, or from the Presidential Medal of Freedom presented to her in 2011 by President Obama. Late in the day on Wednesday, I was driving my daughter to a dance rehearsal when National Public Radio's Melissa Block introduced a recording that Maya Angelou had made for NPR of her poem, Still I Rise. It was enough to get even a 9-year-old to pretty quickly put down the video game and listen. Although I never met Miss Angelou, it would not surprise me if I were to learn that, to her, such moments and mighty little accomplishments might be among her proudest. You have been listening to 40A&M in 5. For more information and for our terms of use, visit 40A-M.com. All stories for this week's download were reported by at least 2 online or print news sources, or taken directly from relevant releases, with the exception of specific reporting highlighted from National Public Radio, The Washington Post, The New York Times, PBS's Frontline program, The Winston-Salem Journal, and NBC News. Thank you for listening. 40A&M and 5 will be back with you again on Monday, June 9th. Until then, make this week and every week one to remember. And bye for now.